and welcome to the Sobre Mesa podcast. As always, I'm your host, Alan Maguire, and we have our long-awaited election recap. General elections were held on the 23rd of July in Spain. Snap election called by Pedro Sanchez less than 12 hours after disastrous local elections. Stay with me, as most of the time when we can get together, is Owen Gil Martin. Owen?
Hey, Alan.
Week for you. How many words have you written this week?
Well, this week, enough. I can't actually remember. Yeah, I think I've another piece coming out today, which is my last thing. So I finished writing last night about 6 o'clock, and then met you and a few other people for drinks. So it's been nice. I now feel I'm free. I've nothing, no deadlines for next month. So I'm happy.
Good, good. And we also have Carlos with us.
Yeah. I'm Carlos Oclos, from a sociologist at the Autonomous University of Barcelona.
Thanks for coming back to Sobre Mesa, Carlos. And Tiare, we have. Is a new guest on Sobre Mesa. Well,
hi, thank you so much for having me. I'm a big fan, as you guys know, and I'm a journalist, and I collaborate with a range of Spanish and Italian media.
Good. You're probably more like, it's like a really Mediterranean mix, right? Spanish and Italian. That's cool.
Yeah, I mean, I'm literally a mix in terms of my parents and like where I'm from. Yeah, literally half Italian, half Spanish. So.
Cool. And from a journalistic point of view, it's a nice comparison, I think. No, it's a good, the two countries, they work well together.
Yeah. Quite interesting, for sure.
Especially right now, right? Italy is a bit hot.
Yeah, it's what the future might have looked like thing, but at least it looks like for the short term, it's not going to go away. So
Owen, I believe you have the results for us. Can you just, I mean, most listeners will know more or less, but can you give us seat counts and things like that?
Yeah, well, obviously, you know, it came as a bit of a surprise. As you were saying, you know, a lot of the polls were going, seemed to be predicting quite a, if not an outright right-wing majority, close to one. And so I think most of us, at least on this panel, felt relieved and a bit of pretty happy on Sunday night when, I mean, more or less, I guess, we can talk about this whether it is a hung parliament or not, but you have basically two pretty equal blocks, the right block and the left block. On the right, the BBB were the largest party, getting 33.1% of the vote and 136 seats. I mean, that's in one sense, it's a pretty remarkable result when you compare it to 4 years ago. They completely consumed the whole electorate coming from the old liberal rightist Ciudadanos. But I think, you know, what was the paper? Did the BBB get something like 20-something% in the last? You know, it's up to 33 now. In second place, Pedro Sanchez, the Socialist Party, 31.7%, 122 seats. They did particularly well in Catalonia, and I think we'll probably talk about that. In one sense, Catalonia was the deciding factor. The vote there was a pretty incredible result, an outright majority of votes for the two coalition parties. The third place was Vox, far right, 33 seats, 12.4%. They dropped 2.5% from 4 years ago, but had a huge drop in seats, losing, you know, close to 20 seats. And so, you know, they, in a sense, are now a pretty marginal force in one sense. They don't have the numbers to, for example, to bring a motion of no confidence this term or to bring appeals in the Constitutional Court. So, you know, in some sense, their most potent institutional weapons are no longer there and available for them. Sumar on 12.3%, 31 seats. A decent, you know, a very decent showing from them, particularly in comparison to the disastrous results in May in the local elections. You know, when we're thinking back only 2 months ago, the combined left fragmented, running against each other in a lot of places. Their combined vote was only 1.5 million. 6 weeks later, 2 months later, 3 million with Sumar and Yolanda Díaz. So in a sense, they managed to double their vote in that period, though slightly down on Unidos Podemos' vote 4 years ago. I mean, after that, we have a mix of sort of Catalan and Basque parties. Guerra Republicana lost quite, you know, they're on seven. They were on 13 seats the last time. Yeah, we'll talk about Catalonia. I really think Catalonia is so important in this vote. And so basically, we have two pretty equal blocks. The deciding vote, the balance of power is held by Junts Catalunya, the right-wing pro-independence party headed by Carles Puigdemont in exile in Waterloo in Brussels. So in comparison to what we were expecting, what the polls were telling us was going to happen, these were great results. And I think the sense of relief among progressives around Spain was, you know, very obvious. I went to Calle Ferraz outside the socialist headquarters. people were joyful. I mean, you know, sort of sense of collective joy, you know, and relief was very obvious.
I was actually camping in Astoria on my phone at 1 a.m. in my tent watching the results come in. I wasn't outside Kaithara, but it did look fun. I mean, the polls were interesting. I mean, I was looking, apparently, the kind of like in Spain, for listeners that don't know, you can't release a poll 6 days before the election day, which is always on a Sunday. But there were 2 weeks before this kind of cutoff point, there were 105 polls released in a week. And the week before that, 94 polls. Comparing that to 2019, like the first week of campaign, there were 66 polls. And the second week before the cutoff in 2019, there were 80. So a really quite a significant jump. And most of them, majority of them, predicted that the PP would get over 140 seats and that a PP and Vox government would get over the 176 threshold for a majority. And CIS, it's kind of a state pollster, I suppose, as best way of describing it. I mean, it has a government official as the head of it, was the closest. And it's always kind of slated for favoring the government of the day, I think, right?
Hold on. If I may make a couple of points here just about the thesis, the Center for Sociological Research, as a sociologist and as someone who works a lot in survey design and quantitative sociology, the issue isn't that thesis always sways on the side of the government at a given time. It's that when PSOE took over, they put a militant at the head of the thesis in Tezanos. Not only that, but Tezanos changed the methodology of survey projections so that it accounted for undeclared or undecided voters in a different way, using different formulas than other surveys. And this was much to the chagrin of many quantitative social scientists, data scientists, et cetera, et cetera. Now, what's telling about this is, you know, there was a lot of critique from the right of Thies in particular, but what there was no critique of was the private polling agencies polling companies that in their own way sort of told their clients what they wanted to hear. And of course, surveys also prefigure the political field by creating a sense of inevitability, by constraining the space of possibilities. And what we saw in this last election, I tweeted about it really early on in the campaign. I said something along the lines of, like, this is actually an affront to democracy, the amount of polling that's coming out and the way that it's being framed, because what we've seen in the last several elections is that the role of undecided voters is actually much, much greater, and that assumptions about turnout, which is what most projections based on the actual survey responses, those projections become far less precise because of those undecided voters, because of the volatility, because of this sort of, you know, who are these undecided voters? Are they people that are undecided between voting and not voting? Are they undecided between left-wing options, right-wing options? Like, those undecided voters can mean a lot of different things. And so when you project onto that, you project a bunch of assumptions. And I think this is the first campaign where I've seen the story of the different polling agencies and their accuracy becoming such a central issue in the media, because there's a real bubble around, Demoscopia and all this kind of stuff right now, with all the data fetishism that exists now due to online media and the data that our activities generate, but also the uncertainty, the instability in our and volatility of our political structures.
Just to move it on a little bit, though, guys.
Yeah, absolute bullshit. Sorry.
In terms of how do you read the results? Because obviously, I think most of us felt relieved, etc. What were the main factors that saw? Well, you know, the right fell short of an absolute majority, but I think it was at 7 seats. The left did better. I mean, I think I was mentioning earlier the result in Catalonia, which, you know, I think was a pretty remarkable result. You have the collapse in the vote for the pro-independence parties. A majority of Catalans voted for the two coalition parties. What's your sort of general analysis of these results? What went wrong for the right and right for the left?
I guess I'll just continue real quick and try to be quick because I don't want to step on Tiade or anyone else's toes. But in Catalonia, it's not the collapse of the independence party vote. There was a call for abstention from the pro-independence movement that was influential Now, how the remaining votes were distributed, I think, is part of the story. But I wouldn't call it a collapse. I'd say that there was, on the one hand, a call for abstention. That
but from who in the independence movement, though? I mean,
Omnium, and folks like that, folks from that orbit, a lot of very prominent columnists, you know, the more kind of hardcore pro-independence types.
And was participation down in Catalonia? I don't know. Oh, actually,
participation was down.
Yeah, it was down. You're right. Actually, it was down.
It was down, I think, 4 percentage points at a certain point. And so,
yeah.
And this is, I mean, the consensus here is that this was the issue with the independence movement. So, but the thing is that also votes from Esquerra, Tony Rodón, and some other quantitative sociologists from Pompeu Fabra and stuff have done some projections. Jordi Muñoz from the CEO looked at where the votes from each party likely went. And it seems that, yeah, Esquerra voters went in the direction of SC and Sumar Comuns. Same with a lot of CUP voters. And then Junts kind of a little bit more towards abstention. But the one that was the hardest hit clearly was Esquerra Republicana. And, you know, I think that was like a, you know, that gives us a specific read of like who got represented in this election. And I think going into the sort of discussion about pacting, you know, what agreements are going to be reached and all this kind of stuff, I think interpreting the vote of the pro-independence abstainers is going to be the point of dispute between Junts and Esquerra, who seem to have agreed in the last few days to go together in their negotiations of the PSOE. Regarding PSOE and the Sumar government, which I don't think is necessarily bad news. I don't think it's a given that they will support, but certainly with the, I think the prospect of a far-right government is really, really noxious. The pro-independent, well, I think it's really noxious for Catalonia, potentially boost support for the pro-independence movement. I don't know that that's going to be a good thing, though, especially with Abascal and people like that already saying that they will make life worse in Catalonia. And so, yeah, on one level, I think that's part of the read. That's the sort of the specific Catalonia read. And then at a more general level, what did the right do wrong? Well, what the right did wrong was accept fascism as part of their government. I mean, they got a scary number of votes. I'm not convinced that it can't go up more. But I'll say that they have not broken the ceiling that they reached in 2019, really. I think this is a photo of the Spain that we have. You know, my forthcoming texts on this are, the title is The Land of No Majority. That's where we've been at in Spain for the last decade. Yeah. And, you know, there's a pluralistic democratic Spain.
Yes.
And then there's another sort of monocultural, homogenizing view of Spain that has a very substantial anti-democratic force that I think at this stage, a lot of people don't buy. And, you know, Spain needs to get better at dealing with difference. And that is as true for the left as it is for any other democratic forces here.
Tiarif, how do you read the vote on the right? I mean, the campaign, I mean, the sort of, you had Vox's quite hardcore campaign embracing conspiracy theories run by probably its most extremist wing led by the Catalan ex-phalangist Jorge Buxete. And at the same time, you had the PP's campaign, which was a bit of a disaster. Specifically the last week, it seemed to go off the rails. You had a very uncharismatic, you know, sort of traditional conservative trying to play the Trump card, but not quite being able to pull it off, maybe with Feijóo. How do you view the right's results and the two campaigns?
Yeah, so I do think a very representative kind of conclusion would be to say precisely that the Spanish people just didn't buy it. Like, we just didn't buy it. And fundamentally, Pepe barely had any proposals. If you think about it, this is true for Sanchez, who basically ran a campaign on mostly being anti-far right and kind of that saved democracy. He really reminded me of the Biden campaign in this sense. To be honest, though, Feijóo kind of did the same thing. Like, he ran against Sanchez. He was like, anti-Sanchismo, let's save Spain from disaster. And Vox really leaned into the alarmism, and it was incredibly kind of negative, and he really took on this victim role. He can, like, ask Al in this three-person debate, which, by the way, I think really helped the left. Like, I really can see people who watched it changing their mind. Like, it was really obvious who was right and who was wrong there. Just
That obviously was a huge error on Feijóo's part. No, he refused to participate in this debate. I mean, the last leader's debate, he didn't turn up for 5 days before the election.
Absolutely. And I think he later on realized that he just let the left win, because in comparison to Abascal, it was just so obvious. Like, it was astonishing. And Abascal just kept kind of playing victim. And I think people are a little bit tired of that. And clearly it wasn't successful. And I think Sumar kind of did the opposite of that. They really broke away from that victim role. In kind of like how they approached the campaign. I think it's Sumar a campaign that I very much admire. I think it was pretty clear that they went in a direction, first of all, of having a kind of cheerful, hopeful, exciting kind of attitude and aesthetic to an extent, but also promise in terms of bread and butter issues. The campaign was a lot precisely about those issues, and Yolanda Diaz was on, what I saw was that on every interview she repeated and repeated and repeated her proposal, her like policy proposals, and honestly I think that is the best she could have done, because people really are exhausted of the drama and the noise, like she's in ruido, from the last 4 years, but also before that. The left is known pretty much everywhere, but especially like the specific context of Podemos was overwhelmingly noisy, and it had gotten to a point where it was just so like literally annoying to people. And so I think she really put emphasis on drawing away from that. And you know, the policies that she's suggesting are like hugely centered on work, on labor, such as, you know, the reduction of the workday. Instance, I think she really talked about free time and time in relation to work. And I think that was the core of her campaign, and it made the core of this project. That is to be seen, because this is like a newborn baby and we don't really know that much about it yet. And yeah, I mean, fundamentally, I think people just didn't buy the kind of offer of basically simply getting rid of Sanchez. Like, there wasn't that much more there. And I also think it is pretty shocking the level at which Spain is really divided by kind of areas. It's really, I think, a very good case of that, where Catalonia, for instance, is definitely more leaning a lot towards the left. For instance, Madrid, the opposite of that.
Madrid is in Spain. And I think that's what this election has shown, is that I think one thing that PP and the Spanish right in general is far too Madrid-focused, Madrid-centric. You know, it's obviously a lot of its ideological lines come from the Madrid-based press, you know, newspapers like El Mundo, La Razón, etc. And that works in Madrid. It works in other areas in, you know, the interior, Castilla, etc. But it's not, maybe not enough to win a majority in Spain. One of the issues is, like, yeah, I mean, Ayuso can win an absolute majority in Madrid with a very Trumpian line. It doesn't translate into the rest of the country necessarily. Going back to you, Carlos, I mean, How do you evaluate maybe Sumar's campaign? I mean, it seemed to be in part a Sumar is obviously the new left unity platform led by the Labour Minister Yolanda Díaz, you know, hastily put together before, you know, when these snap elections were called. They managed to reach a unity deal, as Diarra said, you know, with a lot of fractious fallout around the exclusion of Irene Montero from the list, etc. The Podemos number two and equality minister. What, I mean, it seems in part a campaign with two distinct stages, at least. No, the first stage, which was still, you still had this hangover maybe from the fallout of Irene Montero's veto, and at the same time, it was a campaign very much focused on programmatic issues, just sort of every day a new policy announcement, but it didn't necessarily have the right framework to try and to get this across. It was a little bit superficial. I think they presented her too much in transversal sort of terms, like Manuela Carmena. She is not Manuela Carmena. Her campaign came alive when she sort of combined this programmatic appeal with a more confrontational approach in the last sort of week, 10 days. She went on the attack, particularly in the debate against Abascal, also in a series of interviews against Fijo, which was much more successful than, I remember her early interview in El Intermedio, and she just smiled and she said she wasn't going to say a bad word about anyone in the campaign, but unfortunately politics is about confrontation, it's about antagonism. And luckily her campaign team did switch in that direction in the last sort of 10 days. They should have done it earlier. But how do you read the campaign, Carlos?
I think Sumar, when the idea came out, the idea was to have it was a very conscious use of this term, have a process led by civil society. We didn't get that. We got...
Civil society in Spain is... progressive civil society is very demobilized. I mean, it is... These are the contradictions of launching a new platform, not like with Podemos after a movement wave.
Right.
And this, you know, this upsurge.
Yeah.
But from government.
Yeah, that's my point, is that it's not a bottom-up process. I mean, what we got... Sumar's results are kind of like the historical ceiling for Izquierda Unida. What we have is Izquierda Unida. And good. Thank goodness. that's fine. I'll take it. In 2023, with the rest of Europe going hard right, I'll take it. A coalition between, you know...
I mean, they doubled the vote in comparison to the May election. Obviously...
Yeah, we can't...
Yeah. Tell me why that's more complicated.
That's more complicated because you don't have the same turnout for local and regional.
That's true, exactly.
As you do for national elections, and they're not voting in the same key. And local elections are a lot more about the person and the candidate than they are about parties and the direction of the country. And I think what's scary to folks is to see, you know, right-wing nut jobs taking down rainbow flags and banning books in Catalan as there's a national election campaign, and saying, hey, is this really what we want to show the world? Like, in a country that's been a reference point for how to handle the pandemic, not just the actual pandemic in and of itself.
Is it fair to say there that was Pedro Sánchez's tactical brilliance, in the sense, or at least in the sense,
yes,
you know, calling the election to coincide with these regional and local negotiations, with Vox entering government across, you know, at a local and regional level across the country. We have these images of, pride flags being taken away, Buzz Lightyear, you know, very, you know, I mean, just ridiculous stuff being banned.
Yeah. I mean, Pedro Sánchez is a smart politician. I mean, every time that I think that he's doing something nuts, he's very comfortable with uncertainty, which is interesting about him. And he's not just uncomfortable with uncertainty, but he's developed something of a reputation for being audacious. Unfortunately, that means he's audacious in terms of the politics of things, not in terms of policies.
Exactly.
I'd like to see him be more audacious in the realm of policy.
He's audacious over short distances, not these tactical maneuvers to get and normally to get him out of. I mean, he'll have whole periods of inaction, and then when his back is against the wall, then he'll move. But
but he's happy to welcome that, I think. And so I think, you know, going back to Sumar, it's a difficult question, because I actually think Tiare's analysis was spot on. I think in this election, it's very possible that a more confrontational campaign would have actually created more turnout for the right. Pablo Iglesias, when he ran in Madrid, you know, in the local elections there, he generated a lot of turnout of the right. And lost in that regard. When he stepped out of the government and ran in Madrid, he mobilized the right to some extent, or at least that, I think, was his reading in his own statements. He was like, okay, ya no sumo, right? And as premeditated as his decision might or might not have been, I think, you know, there's some truth to that statement. And so I think the tone of this election might have been a bit more of like, look, we're the reasonable, normal people. Let's let them be weird. And make the country look like really goofy and not feed into that. That might have been what explains the results and so on. Now, does that connect with a certain type of voters? I don't think so. But at the same time, I don't think we should kid ourselves about the degree to which there was some kind of bottom-up effervescence on the left in Spain over recent years. There hasn't been. COVID has been catastrophic for bottom-up organizing. We have not been able to take advantage of the face-to-face relations and proximity that we need in order to build popular power and to build autonomy from the institutions. That's just not there. And so I think these elections are a lot more institutional. I think the decision to be more policy focused and so on the part of Sumar, you know, it turned out all right.
I mean, again,
the geography.
I would just push back on that a little bit in the sense there's different ways to be confrontational. I mean, you know, her, in a sense, she was confronting the right as opposed to this populist dichotomy of Iglesias a few years.
That's what I was thinking, with Galicia, for instance, like the map of sort of the vote in Spain, I think was relevant. So like the fact that Yolanda Díaz and Feijóo are both from Galicia and she could really press Feijóo on cavorting with drug dealers and all this kind of stuff and talk about, look, in Galicia, we've lived with this guy. We know what he's like. It didn't do a ton for her results in Galicia. But I think in the rest of Spain, it kind of brought Galician politics and his time in Galicia more into the foreground in a way that might have mobilized turnout. But, you know, it wasn't just Catalonia that turned out. Andalucía turned out quite not all the way in favor of PSOE, but much, much better than it has.
I think this was very important in the sense that I guess the PP were banking on Sanchez Mono and his connection with Basque and Catalan nationalists would deter socialist voters in those type of areas. In the end, the fear of Vox was much greater than any dislike or not. Okay,
not just the fear of Vox, because I think the most interesting kind of quick tweet take that I've seen in English on this was David Adler when he from Progressive International when he shared this graphic from eldiario.es. A little analysis they did of the distribution of votes. It's territorial, and there's all these kind of issues that we need to get into. It's too boring for a podcast, but it basically showed that on the left and on the right, Vox and Sumar have been able to build sort of cross-class coalitions that are not majoritarian, but they're kind of tugging at the ideological ends, I guess, on some level, even though they're not. I don't want to get into some horseshoe bullshit, but they do have some sort of cross-class coalition. The class vote is in the mainstream parties, and there we see a clear difference of support skyrocketing for PSOE amongst the bottom 20%, the bottom fifth of the income distribution, whereas for the top fifth, it skyrockets for the Partido Popular. So the class vote is in the mainstream parties, and the bulk of the problem of inequality in Spain for the last decade and above, since the crisis, has been concentrated in the bottom 20% of the income distribution, which had, at the outset of the Sanchez government, a minimum wage of 735 euros a month that is now 1,080. And so that, you know, is a very tangible thing, even
That's
though
true.
It's reformist, even though it's like boring, whatever, but it's a 40% increase in a context of inflation, sure, but it's still 40%. We don't have 40% inflation. So I think working class strongholds, such as the mining regions of León, Asturias, and these places, they have historical memory, and they're not going to go in the direction of the fascists who, in places like Castilla and León, are destroying union bargaining, social dialogue, all these kinds of things. So I do think class came out, but class came out in favor of PSOE, not in favor of Sumar, and not in favor of Vox, and also on the top end, in favor of Pepe. There's just not that many rich people in Spain.
Oh, well, I was just going to say, I thought Pedro Sanchez, when we were talking back about Pedro Sanchez, it was interesting how for the last week he was relatively quiet, quite a quiet in the debates, kind of quiet. But when he called the election, I mean, the man was all over television. You couldn't get rid of him. He was on every Generation Z podcasts, Hormiga, all of these different, he was anywhere and everywhere all at once. And then he kind of just took a step back. I don't know if it's because he was being a bit overshadowed by Yolanda Díaz's like turn and at the debates when she got a bit more confrontational. But I did think it was interesting how he sort of took a step back and it went a bit quieter really. But I mean, they were the party that were predicted to lose seats at like 20, no, almost 20 seats, some people polls were saying, and they gained two. So, I mean, yeah, that was relatively interesting.
Thierry, how did you see the socialist campaign? I mean, it was a lot of they sort of managed to create their own version of Dark Brandon with the memes, etc. How did you see the socialist campaign?
Yeah, so partly I did feel like it was extremely on the defensive. I really think they obsessed over like, let's stop Vox, but I would say Pedro Sánchez really was brilliant in what he did in terms of being just everywhere all the time. I think that was a pretty interesting move, which clearly paid off. And I think, you know, it really says something about this idea that we shouldn't go because of morals or ethics or whatever argument. We shouldn't be on shows that are basically right wing, sometimes extremely so. But I think it was a good idea to actually go. And honestly, I wish he had done it before. But I also am quite happy that it was a party. It was enough to just go now. And I think we really have to, you know, analyze that and learn from that and actually not just disappear from those shows for another 4 years and you know, just there. Because when you see someone and they are so clearly on the right, like on the right as in correct, on issues and, you know, just really responding to the attacks that are being made against them, I think that clearly was useful. And I think for anyone watching, for instance, El Hormiguero, I mean, I do think that was a pretty obvious win for Pedro Sánchez. Like, he really looked like the winner in all of these instances. And for Yolanda, yeah, I think there was a lot of that element of we are the normies, we are the weirdos. and also, like, they are like, you know, this idea of like the crazy, like, social justice world. Like, no, Yolanda was basically like, no, it's more like the opposite. Like, I'm the normal one. and not just normal, but, you know, she looked beautiful. And I get that can be superficial in a way, but I also think there is an element of like a desire for warmth and beauty and, you know, that kind of almost motherly aura that obviously in a kind of fake, sinister instance, you can see in people like Meloni, for instance, like they really play this role of like this motherly figure. And I think Yolanda kind of took a little bit of that. And I think between her and Pedro Sánchez, who also has like this great image and, you know, he obviously knew how to get good at his interviews. I think they play the card of, you know, how are we appearing? Like, how are we looking? It is clear that it did play your favor. And yeah, the PSOE campaign, again, I do think it was extremely on the defensive, which was predictable, to say the least. I also think Pedro Sánchez really, like, you could really tell how keen this guy was to, like, look good. And, you know, like, he did look kind of way, I think. Like, I think he really managed. And, yeah, I think ultimately, whatever we think about that, the ultimate conclusion should be, or at least one of them should be, yes, we need to be in these shows. Like, we need to. And it's a good idea. It's useful. No matter how awful they are, it's still a gain. They are awful, but maybe people watching aren't. Or at least they're not like this lost soul that you can't bear being like in the presence of, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, it does. I mean, one of the things he said, I think, on the Ana Rosa show was that, in a sense, that the, you know, obviously, yeah, as you've been saying, is that the right dominate these media spaces, and maybe more so than 2015, when we think back, that there seemed to be, you know, Jordi Evole, things like that, the Salvados, where, you know, we can discuss the limits of those type of spaces, but they came at least in a progressive framing. And, you know, his famous interview in 2016 after he had resigned as socialist leader at that moment, you know, he had a you know, at least somewhat of a progressive media space to have this this high profile interview in. And I think it does seem, you know, obviously it's just, in terms of ownership of media spaces, it hasn't changed. It's two, you know, these two big private companies. But Carlos, has the media sphere in Spain, at least I don't know, we can talk also about, you know, social media, alternative media, but the general media sphere, has it sort of contracted since 2015, do you think?
Well, I think one thing we should remember is that Pablo Iglesias got his start for most of Spanish society by going on El Gato al Agua, which is a far-right channel on a far-right program on Intereconomía. And it was by going himself against four far-right pundits and just absolutely wrecking them because they didn't have a way to typecast him, or they had typecasted him wrong. And he just pulls them absolutely apart. That's how he got his start. That one video went viral. And I want to push back a little bit on this point that, like, maybe he should have been going the whole time. I'm tempted to think that, Tiare. But at the same time, I think part of what might have made this finally going to those shows so effective was that he hadn't been on before. Mm. So yeah. That lets this other opinion of him build up. And then suddenly this guy shows up and is like, wait, this guy's reasonable. And again, with the second debate, the vibe of the second debate with them two going against Abascal was that, okay, the adults are in the room. You know, that was very much like, you know, okay, party's over, guys. You know, the serious people are here, and we're gonna start talking about policy, and we're gonna point out how weird you look. You know, because when you're coupling the goofy things that Santiago Abascal says, you know, with accusations of Pedro Sánchez being associated with the worst of Spanish society and all this kind of stuff, it's like, okay, well, then this guy's just nuts. And the thing with Yolanda Díaz is, you know, Yolanda Díaz in 2011, she was one of the few politicians that did well in the elections of 22nd of May of 2011, the local elections where, you know, she picked up some seats, and she was one of those people that were in Izquierda Unida, in the PC, the Partido Comunista, that actually seemed to understand 15M from the beginning. And so the fact that she was that part of that tradition, I think, makes her a politician that's a lot more, and just inspires a lot more trust in your average Spaniard than others, as long as they're not like super ideological and automatically associate the Spanish Communist Party, which is probably the most responsible for bringing democracy to Spain, associates them with like fucking Stalin or some bullshit. So, you know, I think that's kind of that played an important role. But in terms of the media sphere, I think the media has been playing a huge role in the last few years, particularly, I think, actually, since COVID. I think sociologically something has happened with COVID where social media invades our lives even more in a way that we don't even notice, actually, because we're already very online. But terminally online is a very post-2020 thing. And I think our information spheres have become a lot more siloed during that period. And the spaces where, you know, contamination from different ideologies actually takes place, that doesn't take place anymore because we're so segregated online and so segregated in our media spaces. And so the degree to which television and mainstream media try to dialogue with social media in this sense interacts with that segregation in a way that I think is, you know, quote unquote, polarizing. I think polarization is not the right term. I think it's more segregation. We are essentially bigger and tinier niche markets that interact with one another far and far less. But of course, Podemos itself is a media construction. That is to say, it's a media construction built by people who were trying to figure out the social movements of 2011. That is to say, yes, you can say both Podemos and Ciudadanos, and to add a third, Vox, are largely media constructions, but they're different because Podemos was civil society, or, you know, the Indignados sort of kicking the door down and saying, let us in, whereas the others were constant fabrications of powerful elites in the media, in the you know, the elite of society and the ownership structure of Spain, trying to fabricate a media phenomenon that'll appeal to, you know, a far right segment that can counterbalance what was happening and pigeonhole what was happening on the left. And so, yes, I do think that the media, I ultimately think I'm a bit of a media determinist in this regard, in the sense that I think that 2011, all this kind of stuff that happened since then, we can largely attribute to technological changes, including the decline of the mass appeal of the upstart left, because algorithms and so on have been so good at channeling and tailoring and separating different types of profiles from one another. And I think that's really the challenge that we need to break now. And I'm personally of the opinion that the work to be done, if we manage to get another coalition government, and we don't have to set the clock back, I think the work to be done is to sort of break down some of these barriers through actual person-to-person interaction in the streets, actually building solidarity face-to-face, actually doing that in our spaces of work, in our neighborhood associations, and so on.
Back up.
Yeah, sorry, I just wanted to add something to that point on Yolanda Díaz being, you know, perhaps more someone who the Spanish people feel like is easier to trust, like this, you know, trust, and perhaps more like a more kind of solid quote unquote offer than the, you know, big 15M kind of idea of Podemos was, and what they've kind of carried with them. And I feel like that's an important point to kind of link to what Carlos was saying about class vote, right? Like, yeah, the class vote is on PSOE. Like, that's how one of the ways that we can analyze kind of what the class politics are, that vote is on PSOE, which is, I think, clearly a more kind of traditional party structure, party kind of outlook, just everything that they are is definitely of a completely different kind than Podemos, which is more kind of from the beginning movement based, and kind of based around this idea of the 99% against the 1%. Without really having that kind of more clear-cut class analysis. And also kind of, you know, if you look at who the leaders are, they are often connected to the universities. You know, whether you look at Pablo Iglesias or Ibarrejón, etc. And I think there is a difference with Sumar in the sense that Sumar, as we can see with Yolanda, is very tied, or at least more tied, to labor and to unions. And I do think that is a little bit more similar to the kind of PSOE type political organization. And, you know, I wonder whether Sumar will take this, because there are, like, the thing about Sumar is that it's extremely diverse,
yeah,
which they seem to be very proud of. And I think in part that is great, because the left is at a point where we're just in huge disagreement, right? So if you want to reflect the actual left, you're going to have to kind of be that way. But I think it will be interesting to see, like, the direction they follow. Are they going to follow a more union-focused, labor-focused direction in a kind of Bernie Sanders style, if you will? Or are they going to kind of go back to the Podemos kind of approach, which is probably more based on, you know, ideas of lawfare and, you know, democracy, anti-fascism, historical memory, like Memoria Histórica in Spain, and also, you know, movementism, like with feminism, etc.
No, definitely, it's, you know, I guess that the, Yeah, at the moment, Sumar is an unfinished project. It was hastily, you know, this coalition was hastily put together in a very, very short period of time. Maybe Yolanda Díaz should have had a, you know, moved faster, but I think she wanted to wait for the local elections to negotiate on a stronger term. And then Sanchez sort of outflanked her in that sense. I mean, I guess the big ambiguity in Sumar, as you were saying, Tiare, is that it's, you know, I guess the project is defined as green laborism. And my worry is that it's part of the campaign and some of the people coming from the Catalan Greens, there is a worry it's going too close to sort of German green, middle-class environmentalism and away from Yolanda's roots in labor, in the unions, etc. Maybe just to move it on a little bit, what's going to happen next? I mean, we have this situation in which the PP has no chance of forming a government. I don't know what you guys think. Is Feijóo dead? Is he gone? And secondly, are we going to get a second progressive coalition backed by quite a diverse group of parties and ultimately the abstention of Junts? So I'm not sure who wants to take that. Carlos?
This approach of like saying, you know, we're Spain and what defines Spain is hating what we claim are two parts of Spain is kind of disastrous, especially when those are two really important economic centers. And I guess you really can't. I'm happy to see that you still can't form a majority by criminalizing entire populations of Spanish people.
My worry is that they, if I mean,
you
I,
can't,
I,
yeah, you might be able to.
Yeah, you might. I mean,
that's the thing. But if I were Pedro Sanchez right now, I would say, look, Junts, I'll pardon Puigdemont, because the thing is, I pardoned everybody else last time and I got almost the same sort of voters. I think that one of the things that has been sort of ratified in these last elections, and I might be wrong, but is like, okay, look, faced with the prospect of a fascist government or, you know, pardoning one guy for something that we know was not what it's being painted as.
Yeah.
I think Spanish voters are far more mature than the Spanish right wing. Yeah. I think that's kind of what happened. I'd hope that that's the case. But if I were Sanchez, I'd be like, look, Junts, what do I got to do? And Junts, the other thing with Junts right now is that they need to know that if a referendum were held right now, they don't win. They don't win. The support is that for independence is at an all-time low in Catalonia right now, precisely because that's what happens when there's a progressive government in Spain. And the reason that there was an increase in support for independence was when the Rajoy government, the absolute majority of Rajoy, took over. And it was, we saw an absolute majority of the party that took the Statute of Autonomy, which they did vote on legally. They took it to the Constitutional Court, legalized the whole damn thing, the whole damn conflict, and turned it into this identitarian bullshit. And they've put the entire region and the entire country on hold and at war with itself, or in a cold war with itself, for a decade on this petty bullshit. And I think a lot of Spanish people are fed up with it. And I really hope that it's no longer politically profitable for the right. We'll see what it means in Catalonia. Now, I don't think a referendum is going to, I think that's not going to be really a big part of, I don't think that's going to be a real concession. I think a referendum on a new statute of autonomy might be. I think that's something that.
And the other demand is amnesty. I mean, is that some sort of partial amnesty? Is that possible or just not?
No, I don't think that's going to happen. But I think.
Can you pardon Puigdemont before he's been tried? I mean, he hasn't been convicted of anything.
That's the thing. So, I mean, that would be the process, right? So, it doesn't work like the U.S. pardons, where you can pardon people, you can do a presidential pardon before they even go to trial. I think in Spain, they have to go to trial. But in any case, I think that would be, that's the bargaining chip. Not just Puigdemont, by the way, a lot of folks that are far more anonymous. And also, you know, there's competencies, Rodalies, so the Cercanías trains in Catalonia, things like that folks actually want here that make sense to want. To a certain extent, Like,
so more regional powers, basically.
Yeah, that's gonna be a people are ready to cash in their chips, you know, like a little bit on this. I don't think that the process is like completely over, but I think that they're in such a state of recomposition that I don't think they would win a vote. And so because they wouldn't win, I don't think they want the referendum. But who knows? We're talking about national identities. This is not rational choice.
No, exactly. The incentives are there, but yeah, exactly.
Those abstainers abstain because they're like really, they really feel it, man. You know.
Yeah.
Sorry,
Thierry. What about you? Are you confident there's going to be a deal for a left wing a progressive coalition?
Yeah, I am pretty confident there is going to be, because, quite honestly, why would Junts, you know, not prefer coalition government on the, you know, center left? Like, they would definitely lose part of their autonomy if there was the opposite of that, which is kind of the only option. And yeah, so I mean, I think ultimately the things they're asking for, or, you know, these Rodalias, etc., like these things, yeah, they it's doable to me, especially after, you know, considering that Sanchez knows that he's not, you know, he hasn't lost power. He's actually kind of in good position right now. So he knows this is after people know that he has, you know, pardoned these leaders. And on top of that, yeah, like people, the last time they didn't vote this government in, if you will, this time they have, the people have endorsed what Sanchez has done. So it's fundamentally that. I don't see a reason why. Like, I can see how, you know, Junts.
Yeah, just to explain that to listeners. Yeah, 4 years ago, Sanchez said he wouldn't do this deal, basically. Yeah, he did. Yeah.
Exactly. I mean, he basically, like, last time people were voting, and one, they didn't know this happened, which is obvious. And second, yeah, for listeners who haven't been following for that long, yeah, he was firmly stating that he wouldn't do this. For instance, coalescing with Podemos, right?
Yeah.
Or, you know, I mean, on, you know, on certain, like, he keeps repeating this, and I get that. Like, he said he didn't want Podemos on certain spheres of power, and he, quote unquote, hasn't given them those spheres of power. But I mean, we all know that he was acting as if he wasn't going to do a lot of the things he actually ended up doing. Which is to have more dialogue with the left and with the independent movements. He definitely didn't do that. And they did have, like, they did build a coalition government, which has lasted up until now. And yeah, now people knew this was gonna happen. Like, it was not, like, it was no question whatsoever. Like, people knew. So he has that kind of extra legitimacy, if you will. I do think there's gonna be a coalition government. I'm not saying it's super easy, but, or, like, you know, to take for granted, but it really doesn't seem like there's any other option for anyone. So yeah, I think that's what's gonna happen, probably.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the last question is it sustainable? I mean, I guess, yeah. What are we thinking? Like, sort of a short-lived coalition? I mean, obviously, who knows? Actually, it's a bit speculative, isn't it? But I mean, it's such an unstable majority. And could they keep that type of coalition on the road for 2-3 years? Like, could they pass a budget? I mean, it's such a ideologically diverse budget. I mean, a diverse coalition. You know, you have, in a sense, the two right-wing nationalist parties, liberal nationalist parties now, will have quite a lot of leverage. I mean, I talked to one Catalan analyst yesterday, he sort of said maybe the focus will be more on democratic reform, stuff around the judicial power, etc., and less ambition maybe on social issues. That's not necessarily a bad thing. The Spanish state needs democratic reform. I think we're probably all agree on that. And there is, you know, you can see the way the best way our describing these parties as, you know, the democratic right, I guess, as opposed to the sort of, you know, undemocratic Spanish right. So yeah, I mean, I don't know what last thoughts maybe. How long is what is the future in that sense?
I mean, I think the next two elections that are coming up that are like a big deal are precisely the Basque and Catalan elections. So I think, you know, if they want to redo the coalition government, they have a sort of a litmus test that's coming up pretty soon to see how things are aligning. And I think even from the perspective of Junts, who again are kind of unpredictable in this regard, but if they wanted to be conservative and strategic, I mean, you know, it would be better for them to have veto power over a progressive coalition, and then kind of test the waters in their regional elections, than it would be to, you know, have Catalonia be intervened by a right-wing government again. Now, there's a sickening reading, which is if that happens, then independence, support for independence will skyrocket, but there's no guarantee that that would go to Junts necessarily. It would likely, you know, it could potentially go to Popular Front. It could be capitalized upon by the CUP, who I think, you know, unfortunately has sort of disappeared from the national scale. Well, I don't know if unfortunately, because they were always a municipal project to begin with and most interesting as such. But you know, they might really profit from it at the Catalan level. So you don't know, but I think that builds in sort of like a little bit of a degree of like, okay, you know, the risk is a bit lower for them if they decide to go with it. And they could even get one of their guys out of jail. So that might. That I think that could be an important bargaining chip, but I don't know. I mean, Spanish politics, you know, it's volatile.
Yeah.
It's volatile, but based on very small movements between blocks, right? I keep saying that, like, putting such massive decision making power in the hands of the undecided vote, of specifically very undecided folks, is kind of a risky proposition. And I think one of the things that hurts the left a lot of the times is that they're the institutional left. I think they have a problem sometimes of like relying too much on abstainers or folks that either abstain or vote left. And that's quite fragile. Yeah. So I don't know how they could possibly shore that up. The only thing that I can think of, again, is to develop strong counterpowers, strong working class institutions, autonomous institutions, autonomous institutionality, all this kind of stuff. Well, you know, outside of parties that can condition those parties and also provide a base of resistance for when they're not in government. But I don't know. I don't know what the future holds. I'm at a point right now where I'm like, I'm not one to make very long term forecasts.
No. And Thierry, what about the Pepe? What about is Feijóo? Is he politically dead? Do you see any way back for him? Can he, like Alan? You were tweeting the letters, no, the Liz Truss letters the other day. Feijóo or the letters, which will survive longer?
I don't really think he's gonna be gone that soon. To be honest, I think one of the reasons that I think that. Is that they, you know, the PP is really doing the thing of like, well, clearly we've lost, but we keep repeating that he's the one with the most votes. So, you know, guys, actually, it's the Sanchez government that's going to be illegitimate because he's not the winner. So they are building like this story. This is the narrative that they've gone for. So from that, I kind of gather that, yeah, there's really no apparent reason why they'd be doing that if they aren't gonna keep him in power. And another reason that I think he's not gonna be gone all that soon, I mean, he might, like, you know, I think it's rather unclear at the moment, but another thing to consider is that Ayuso, yes, she's super popular in the in Spain, and she's super popular, but in Madrid, right? Like, I don't see that they would assume that she'd be a winning candidate. She's a very specific politician for a very specific public, and I think they're looking for something a bit more generic. And, you know, I think Feijóo kind of embodies that. So I think it's more likely to be him or someone else of his kind of profile type. That being said, yes, Ayuso is extremely popular and they might be so desperate that they go for the Trump lady. I mean, so I don't know. But I don't know. I'm not so sure he's going to go that soon. He might. I'm not positive on it. But yeah, I think I agree that the key in terms of, okay, what can we do if we are leftist in Spain? And I think, yes, it is to build more working class power. I think, you know, there is definitely a problem with how unions, for instance, are organized right now, in the sense that on one side, there are hegemonic unions that are so close to, I mean, in this case, likely the government, up until now, the government, in the form of, you know, Yolanda Díaz. And I do think unions could be politically involved, but I think the level, you know, at which this is happening, just to put it simply, is a little bit extreme in the sense on the part of, you know, Comisiones Obreras, which, by the way, I'm affiliated to.
Are you talking particular? I mean, I guess the level of social peace in, you know, we've last year there was a huge drop in living standards, real wage terms, but very little strike.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I think more needs to be done. Not against the government per se, but against the capitalist class. I think we can't act like, you know, Izquierda Unida, like, you know, a leftist party being in the government, some sort of reason for working class organizations to, you know, just chill. on the other hand, though, I do have a problem with other unions, just saying it then. With respect, I don't think being so much on the margins is a good idea. I think that's a horrible plan. Like, I think being so just content with literally being on the margins that you kind of are proud with, I don't think that's a good plan. I think that's a problem. And this is what I mean. Like, I think we need to rethink how we are unionizing, but also we need to unionize. I don't see that happening. Like, I see, and I mean, if you just look at the numbers, the support for, you know, feminism, for instance, is huge, wherever you find yourselves on that movement, by the way, because, you know, I am a feminist, but I always feel like I need to, you know, when someone tells me I'm a feminist, especially in this country, I always wonder, okay, what kind of feminist? Because it's, you know, extremely divided. That being said, it does have huge support. And I just don't see that for unions. I feel like there's this sense that people are really set on fighting for a certain set of rights, but they've completely given up on other areas of struggle, which to me should be the heart of struggle for anyone who isn't in the capitalist class, which is, you know, probably parties and unions. But yeah, like, that is to be seen. I think the way further for leftists is that, is a working class organization. But right now, that doesn't really seem to be at a great point, nor in Spain, neither anywhere else, really, to be honest. Like, I think that's just something that we know on the left. Like, that's not, we're not at a great place. But yeah, I do think that's ultimately what needs to happen. And I think that will also help to kind of solve some of the huge tensions that have been happening in the feminist movement, where, you know, a much needed movement has become some parts of it have become hateful. To be honest, I think the kind of anti-trans, anti-sex were part of it, which are honestly quite significant in Spain, especially the anti-sex word, are honestly, they turn into hate movements. Like, it's just wild to me. And yeah, I think when we focus more on our, you know, material conditions and on identifying as workers rather than as consumers, or, you know, how we, like, who we are, instead of who we are, we think of where are we going. I think that would really not just get us where we close to where we need to be, but also, you know, go away from certain hateful and just stressful and noisy situations that have taken place.
Trying to think. I mean, on the left, I mean, with Somara, it could blow up still. I mean, it's still a baby. It's less than 8 weeks old, more or less. I mean, it's older than that, but really the composition of power in it is was only put together less than 8 weeks ago, not 9 weeks ago now. And, you know, less than 24 hours after the elections, the Podemos leader comes out and basically criticizes the leader that she's meant to have been campaigning for, what wasn't really campaigning for. I mean, it's difficult to know whether they were sidelined in the campaign or not. But, you know, coming out and criticizing your leader, you've just tried to make president, saying you've lost 750,000 votes, feminist votes. I think on both Podemos and Vox are going to be very volatile, because they've both lost a lot of respectable power, like respect with their own voters. They've lost a lot of votes, and they've lost a lot of, and there's going to be lots of questions asked inside their HQs. And I don't think it's going to be constructive, maybe, especially for Somar. I mean, Vox are their own party, but yeah, for Somar, I think it's going to be dangerous. It could be a power keg waiting to blow up.
I think Somar needs to think very seriously about what its internal decision-making processes are going to be and what structure it's going to take. What is its relationship with civil society? How are they going to handle internal dissent? You know, how do they do these things? And it's basically what they've had, you know, they've only existed for 8 weeks, but the idea has been floating around forever. It's been taking forever to put together, because they kind of just assumed that they would run the clock out on the coalition government, and they called snap elections. But then even so, in Podemos, these decisions weren't made either. Podemos had a very ephemeral sort of structure at the beginning, but it was, you know, a situation that was very much centralized in sort of the core group that formed Podemos, and even in organizations like Comuns, which are, you know, presumably more democratic and stuff, there was a great deal of centralization in the core group, and they have not put, I think, the proper amount of time into, like, developing proper mechanisms of democratic deliberation, accountability, and so on, how to deal with different internal currents and all this kind of stuff in a way that resolves conflicts internally without notables going to the media or to complain about other notables or starting their own currents or starting their own parties and all this fucking petty bullshit high school politics crap that they do. And on the other hand, I do think that, and there's a lot of work to be done in the media. I do think that the Canal Red thing is, you know, it's a good idea. Yeah. I'd like to see that fill up with better, you know, with better content and more plural voices, to be a more open space, to develop an alternative media sphere that's actually rigorous and decent. And yeah, we can talk about CGTCNT some other time, Tiare. I'm very, very happy to have that conversation.
That could be a future episode, the future of Spanish trade unionism, maybe.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah, it'd be great. Sure. Yeah, definitely. Well, look, I think it's been a very thorough analysis from both you guys, and it's really great to have you on.
No, thanks for having us. It's great to be in touch with all y'all.
You are great.
Yeah, no, really, really interesting analysis. Thanks a lot.